Welcome to the Victory Show.
Hey, Victors. Welcome to this episode of the Victory Show. This is the first time you're joining us. I'm Travis Cody, best-selling author of 16 books and the creator of Bestseller by Design. I've had the privilege of helping hundreds of business consultants, founders, and entrepreneurs write and publish their own best-selling books. And through that journey, we've discovered a really fascinating pattern. Why do businesses really struggle to break past that seven-figure per year mark in revenue? So on this show, we sit down with some of the world's most successful founders, CEOs, leaders, and business owners to uncover the strategies to scaling a business, but not just covering the strategies, also covering the mistakes made along the way, the pitfalls, part of the roller coaster ride of being an entrepreneur. So get ready for some deep insights and actionable takeaways that you can apply to your life and business starting now. Today's guest, he's a rare breed. He's part operator, part academic, and all in on building systems to scale. Dr. John Fly III is self-described pracademic and the current CTO of Firm Pilot AI, where he recently led the transformation of a traditional service agency into a high-margin AI SaaS platform that today is valued at nearly $100 million. Over the past 30 years, John has specialized in organizational turnarounds, taking chaotic cost centers and turning them into disciplined, valuation-driven driving assets. He brings a unique edge to his work by applying his doctoral research in continuous improvement directly to engineering organizations, proving that high-velocity execution and deep strategic thinking, they aren't actually opposites, they're a requirement. Now, here's the great thing. He's also a commissioned Tennessee colonel, lifelong polyglot coder, and hands-on builder in every sense. John is just as comfortable debating the ethics of generative AI as he is welding in his home shop. So if you're interested in leadership that fuses theory, code, and real-world impact, you are in the right place. John, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
So what took you into organizational, for your PhD? Continuous improvement.
Yeah, continuous improvement, a big topic in my life because I've been in technology companies for the past almost 30 years.
You've seen a few changes then.
I started coding really early. My dad got a Texas Instrument console system. It wired into the TV, and it had a basic manual. So I started coding around like seven.
Just reading the basic and following the instructions, huh?
Pretty much just, and then it kind of clicked. I'm like, okay, I can change things. And so by the time I was 15, I landed a job with a mortgage software company. My first job, mm-hmm. like a high school job, was mortgage software programming, C++.
What?
Yeah.
And that was it, huh? It was all she wrote at that point.
Well, I mean, it really was, because this was the first job. Was the CEO was wicked smart, and he had a library that was kind of like Visual Basic before Visual Basic. It was a huge wrap around Visual C++. So we had a team of three developers, and we were competing with 30, 40 person shops. And so I got to see, like, right there that having a business edge, having some intellectual property, thinking things through could, like, really be an advantage in this tech world.
Even back then, the solution was like, we just need more people. And you have a business guy going like, I don't know, we can actually get the same thing done with, you know, four versus 40.
Yeah. Yeah. It was wild. I just took that, you know, through the whole career. So, you know, when people are saying like, this is an impossible problem, I'm like, I don't know. It's maybe a little bit possible. Let's take a look at it.
Who was it? I'm going to butcher the quote, but I forget who did the quote, but it was along the lines of challenging things, take a while to figure out, and impossible things just take a little bit longer.
It's really nice. Yeah. When I got back into programming after college, I had a VP who thought I was making waves, and he tried to run me out by giving me a lot of wicked problems, like problems that this old company hadn't solved, many times. And I just I got them done and really had a fant like really had a fantastic time just solving all these hard problems.
Did he eventually stop bringing him to you, or did somebody in the company base eventually go, this guy's selling all the stuff that no one else can? Like, maybe we need to put him in a different chair.
That's it did. I mean, if anybody looks at my career history, I've moved around a lot. I mean, what happened was I was doing a lot of good work and came time for, like a salary adjustment and promotion. And they gave me a teeny tiny little adjustment and said, great, great job. Give it another 20 years.
And you were like, I can go over there and make 30% more. So,
I really, that was true. And
yeah,
so
well,
just,
especially with, even today we're seeing that, right? I mean, just depending what your skill set is and which tech field. What was it? Was that last year? Facebook hired a poached a AI engineer from someone for like a they paid him $1 billion to come over to the
that's
team.
the AI world right now. We're part of it here at Firm Pilot, and it's just it is it's a wild, wild area to be in.
Is it interesting to be in the programming side and to just to see all these kind of like these waves come through where, obviously the internet started to shift stuff, but then it was like you see social media coming and that creates it, and then there's apps coming, and then there's, and now we're like AI is a whole new sort of, language to come around. Is it surprising you, or is it just kind of fun the fact that about every 8 or 9 years you're going to be at this wave that's going to be just like crazy for a little bit?
I would love to tell everybody like I'm part of the crew that sees everything coming. But I'd probably be in the stock market rather than coding and at that. But I remember when the internet came out, I was like, this was like this is a like this is gonna be a big this is gonna change things. Definitely. I was really early, like I had an email address before people knew what email was. And then the smartphones, the came around like the faster cellular, like 3G was a huge change, letting people actually do remote work or do more than phone calls on your phone. Social media, yeah, big splash. But I think everybody's seen that so many times. I think this AI play is having kind of that. I think people are seeing this is going to change things. Looking forward rather than looking back.
It does remind me of the early 2000s where there was all the hype and the and then it's like, did it change things? It did, but it was a lot slower than everyone was saying. And I kind of like with AI, like this last couple of years, obviously there's because there's so much money and so much noise, and I'm going,
Lot of hype.
it is. And I also think probably not going to change things as fast as we're expecting, but it is definitely, and obviously we can talk about this with your work at Firm Pilot, but I'm just out of curiosity, as someone that when I was in college, I thought I wanted to be a programmer, and I went and took a bunch of computer science classes and quickly realized that, because I was a good writer and had a lot of creative juices, that the logical path flow didn't work so well for me. So I got my clocked cleaned in all my computer science classes. Did you, for you, do you think because you started programming at such a young age that being a polyglot programmer became easier for you? Or do you know, are most of the people you work with versed in like five or six or seven different programming languages?
I like to, I'm a tinkerer. My dad would also bring me stuff to take apart as a kid. Like here's an old phone or an old, this or that. Like he was a blue collar worker. And so he worked for the phone company. So he was out and about and he would bring home electronic stuff and I would try and disassemble things and reassemble them to fix them or it didn't matter what. So I really have this, like interest in how do things work, and with a lot of computing, the software component is part of how it works. And so there's just like when you're crafting in the real world, there's different tools, right? Not every hammer has to be a sledgehammer. And I think coding languages and tools are like that. There's not a best, but there's generally best for a certain job.
So interesting, because I just interviewed somebody a couple of days ago, and he's been in AI since like 2001. Mm-hmm. And he was talking about the same thing. He's like, even with AI, he's just like, he's doing this whole diagram where he's like, AI, there's like different tools for different things. And he's like, but everybody's trying to treat it as like the sledgehammer for everything. Mm-hmm. And that was his frustration with everything going on. Now, stop using chat for this. That's not what it's made for.
But it's amazing what people will, I mean, even like once these things kind of run wild and get out there, I think it's surprising what you'll find with, novel uses by kind of the, I don't know.
Normal people,
yeah.
That have no idea what a large language model is or what that is. Mm-hmm. It's like, LLM, what's that? Let me ask chat.
Yeah.
So when did you first start getting exposed to AI and knowing that that's where you wanted to sort of shift your focus to?
So I haven't been big in the AI world professionally. I dabbled with it when I was, in high school and in college. But that just like your other interview, that AI and this AI, like large language models, very, very different. Yeah. I was trying to build some stuff that could identify circles and squares, kind of like early photo analysis, but just basic shapes. And then like game system AI. The last few years though, I've seen more and more machine learning. So I think this is where it came from. Like the machine learning, image analysis, image generation. A few years ago, I was in a job where we were doing spatial analysis, and we're using machine learning AI. And that kind of got me back into the AI world. And the last few jobs I've had have kind of been like startup turnarounds.
Wow.
And I was with a company, and I've just been really frustrated by the marketing aspect. it felt like every conversation with the marketing agencies or the marketing staff were about like rebrands. Like they always wanted us to rebrand,
it's not working. We need to rebrand. Like maybe you need to fix the marketing first.
It really felt like that. It felt like, and when the marketing was working, they just leaned back and said like, yeah, told you. And then the next month when sales didn't, weren't as hot, they were like, well, it's a mystery. Not our fault. We'll rebrand and try again. So when the CEO of FirmPilot and I started talking, this was an excellent opportunity. FirmPilot was a very small operation. They had kind of a proof of concept of their automation. They wanted to scale, but they didn't have any bad habits. So it wasn't a rescue, it was a build. And
that was probably a breath of fresh air.
It was. And it was like, we want to solve this whole, like the whole thesis was, we think a lot of the SEO marketing material world can be done with AI and these large language models that are coming up. And I get like really excited to, I don't know, kind of prove that it's doable. Like I complained about it for 2 or 3 years. Let's go try and take a swing at it.
So how big was FirmPilot when you got on there? And then like, take me through this, the first couple of years you were there in terms of what happened with growth.
Yeah. So I joined, I think right at the first of maybe the first year, maybe employee six or seven.
Early. And
they had, our CEO is very technical. But he had brought on one developer to kind of get things really moving. But he knew he wanted to grow. And, growing a company is not just about, it's people and technology and doing the right thing at the right time and not doing the wrong thing as much as possible. Which is a difficult, that's a difficult thing to do. Hiring top people, people that have experience have opinions, and those opinions can conflict. And so you don't want everybody to think exactly alike, but you can't have dissension. So I think the company's now around the 50, full-timer mark.
Wow.
We've gone from 4 to 6 customers to like around 100, and we are cranking out like marketing content, blogs and social media, Google
So wait a
Business.
minute, you mean you're using your own technology to prove the point of what your technology can do?
Yeah, it's we're generating thousands of blog posts and social media posts and high quality, putting them out there. Our customers are law firms, so the content's got to be
Wow.
entertaining
You guys
enough
aren't
to like.
messing around. You got like that's like there's a lot of like regulation around that. So
Exactly, yeah, and this is why we think it's a very defensible position, is because we're not just farming our stuff out to ChatGPT. We've got a proprietary back-end system that really kind of replicates what we I say it kind of replicates a real marketing agency. It's got, if you think like stops or stations
yeah.
on the content, you've got like a drafter and an editor and somebody that does this and that, except it's all software agents that are kind of building the content as it goes down a pipeline. You got quality checks and all of that. And so we're
So how many agents did you guys have when you started, and how many do you have now?
we really, like when I started, we just had maybe you could think of like just one kind of big agent that tried to do the blogs and the social media. When I came in, we took much more of a kind of like a services approach, where we're splitting things up.
Sure.
So dozens, like several dozen. So it's, if you map it out visually, there's a lot to learn. If you want to try
Sure.
and consume the whole thing, like how does the whole machine work? But what we've really tried to do is make it easy. It's like, you get in a car and you want to drive down the road. A gas-powered vehicle or a EV, they're very, very complex. But you build them where it really is, open the door, turn a key, or now hit a start button.
And you
Step
go.
on the
Yep.
gas pedal or accelerator, and you're off, right?
Well,
Steer.
where I was going with that is I'm just thinking of like your pipeline. And so I used to do sales copy, right? And even in the sales copy arena, there was guys that all they did was VSLs, and some guys all they did was webinars. And there were some guys that are like, I'm just an email guy, right? They all call themselves copywriters. So I was just thinking what you're trying to do, and you're like, we had one big thing. I'm like, yeah, but blog writer and a social and
They're
even
all
social
different,
media,
yeah.
like somebody writing for X is completely different than LinkedIn, which is completely different from Quora and
And so
Medium.
that's how bifurcated it gets down there is yeah, there's the whole blog system's a set of things, and then the social media's a set of things. But we actually the system knows I'm writing a post for this client who prefers this tone and this practice in this state with this aspect of law for X. And they like whimsical tones, or they like serious tones. It's all baked in there.
So how did you, being the CTO, how did you deal with the team growth? Or you guys go from, 5, 6 employees and now you got 50. Like you personally, like how have you managed to go from coder to then also being able to lead other people to drive this forward? And what were the challenges for you in learning that?
So, I guess this kind of goes back to the whole continuous improvement thing is, and me getting into this management game in the first place. I was very much like an introvert, hands-on keyboard coder for the first 10 to 12 years of my career, and I landed a job at a software company, and I had all these achievements in my past where I just conquered stuff because I loved getting things done, and people started noticing that I could do things, and it went from how would you code this to like, do you have any comments on our interview process? And I kind of got pulled into the management leadership aspect of technology, and so I've really just tried to mainly be the manager I wish I had had at certain points in my career, and have the mindset that of continual improvement, where, you know, we want to be good. We don't want to think of ourselves as perfect. And that lets us have just this idea of adaptability. So when I come into a startup and it's like, you know, there's me and one other person, the way we're operating today, like I can sit down. I told the first developer, like, the way we're working today is not the way we're going to be working in a month. It's not going to be the way we're working in 6 months. We're going to continue to evolve. And I think just letting people know that we're going to have to evolve and adapt is comforting.
Yeah.
Because change is hard. Like, change management is really about getting people to get out of routine. And in a startup, you don't really have time to ever form a routine. And so as soon as people figure out how to operate it, you know, six people, you're growing to 10 people. And when, you know, you're comfortable at 10, you got to be 20. Same thing with clients. You know, the moment you're good at juggling a dozen clients, well, sales is bringing them in, you've got 30. So everything has to change. And it's just this continual process of change. And I think the people that fight that are the ones that flame out the most.
That makes sense. So how old were you when you went back to do your PhD? And did you know it was going to be around continuous improvement, or did you study it and went, oh my God, that's what I'm doing on my day job anyway?
So I did my bachelor's when I was, you know, about time. When I got into the leadership roles about, you know, 2010, 2012, I decided, like, I'll go tack on an MBA with a, you know, information technology focus as a differentiator. You know, don't want to stall out there, and actually want to get some more business because I'm tracking towards this management thing. And then a couple of years ago, my son, he went to college, and he went to Liberty online, and I really liked what I was seeing. And I looked at their program, and they had what I thought was an affordable doctoral program in strategic leadership. And like, well, it's if I start that now, I'll graduate near him. And I thought that was kind of cool.
That's cool.
And it did work out. Literally, we completed all our work on the same day. this November. So we basically completed everything on the,
like, you're a fresh PhD.
Yes. Yeah. Wow. Just knocked it out, just published.
What was your dissertation on?
So it was the whole thing's very wordy, but it was the role and impact of leadership on successful continuous improvement.
Wow.
Because as somebody who's been in a lot of companies, right, you've got a management leadership layer, but as the company grows, you get outnumbered by the individual contributor, the team members, right? So I was really wanting to look at what can a leader do to empower and help a team of people be successful, and like legitimately successful, and what are the major impediments and major accelerators of that success.
What were some of the studies that you ran through to kind of work your philosophy?
So it was the case study process took over a year, and I was able to do it on site, and dozens of hours of video and literally hundreds of pages of transcripts to go over.
You able to use FirmPilot as the case study?
No, I was able to use Dave Ramsey's company, Ramsey Solutions. I know some people there, and they're a big practitioner of like lean and Kanban methodologies, which are very heavily focused on continual improvement. And I thought like the continuous improvement work will be really good there. And so, but the main takeaways were, I mean, you know, not shocking, right? This is, you know, I'm not, you know, inventing a new, you know, not trying to discover a new element or something like that. But I was really shocked on as you get down into the teams, there was this like dichotomy of the work, what people think is their work, and what people and how people view improvement work. And it was
Interesting.
really like the commentary was a lot of, improvement is nice when we have time. It was very much like a secondary thing. Like, I have to make time to fit, like to do the, improvement work. I've got these other priorities. Whereas, like, you get in the higher echelons of the organization, and the same thing here with me, with my organizations, I'm hoping everybody's just naturally getting that like we've got to continually improve. We're basically on a treadmill. I think you mentioned when we were chatting earlier, most businesses don't make it past, right, set the six, seven figure mark. Most businesses fail. So I'm constantly telling my team, most businesses fail. So the ones that succeed, even just the average ones that you see succeeding, are by definition like above average, right? The survivors are few and far between. So if we want to thrive, not just survive, we have to be above average. We can't just kind of keep doing it the same way because we're growing. Like, we've got to have that whole adaptability thing. And so the other, so insinuating that message culturally of change is just part of our DNA, or has to be. And then, especially like on the impact of leaders, it really is the power of authentic, transparent, like modeling what you want. So if I want the team to be thinking, adapt, evolve, improve, I have to be instituting some level of free thinking and experimentation and allowing some risk taking. Because I'm actually, because you're asking people to try things out differently and find the best paths. So if I come in there and if I'm a jerk and I allocate everything to 100% and everything, we can't have anything fail, I have to back that up with my actions, right? I have to make sure if they try something and it doesn't work, I don't flip out. If I want them talking about things, I've got to be part of the conversations. So the modeling aspect was one of the biggest things. It's like, you just can't be the charismatic guy who pops in either, gets everybody excited for, change and getting things done, and like, high fives and runs out the door. 'Cause that's what you're modeling. That's what they're gonna do. They're gonna be like, all right, do a little cheerleading session and then like back to business.
So it's always interesting to me where, from a writing perspective, I always have conversations with clients that'll find me on LinkedIn, and they're like, oh, I want to write a book, but it seems big and I'm not a writer, right? And usually I'm, and I started thinking about why do most of us think that way? And then I thought, well, like, when you look at how we as children are taught to write, like, up until we're five or six or seven, generally almost everything you do is celebrated. Oh my God, that's new. You did it great. Oh my God, that's new. You did it great. Oh my God. When you're learning to walk, you fall down, keep going, keep going, keep going. And around seven or eight, like, we're going to teach you how to write. And you're like, cool, I get to learn something new. But now suddenly they're going, did that wrong? Did that wrong? Did that wrong for 12 years, 14 years if you go to college, right? And so then we wonder when we're adults, like, man, why is this? Why do I keep putting writing off my emails? Why do I keep putting off writing that report? Right? Because in the back of our brain, we're like, oh my God, I don't want to get a red X mark. So I think, like, with the education system, and I would assume this is the way with coding, right? There's very, but there, you're taught like there's a right way and a wrong way. And if you do it the wrong way, you're going to get a C. So is there some kind of like having to break coders out of that when they come into work and be like, no, we want you to try to like break things, and
Massive.
you're not gonna fail if you try something that doesn't work, because we're, we spend so much time learning, like, if it's not correct, you're gonna fail the class. Whereas in the real world, right, we're only gonna improve by trying stuff that doesn't work and figuring out, like, oh, that's not an effective way to do it. So I'm just wondering if you could speak to that.
That's like part of the stuff that I when I bring people in, like, I kind of try and prep them with. Just had a new guy come on, so had the kind of status quo conversation with him of the way we operate here is this evolutionary thinking. Like you took this job like part of this, part of the allure of coming into this company is we're going to give you the opportunity to learn and grow, right? And he's like, yeah, like I want to learn and grow. And if that's true, like if you're going to learn and grow, you're going to be better and smarter and know new things in 6 months. And he's like, yeah, I'm going to be better than I am now in 6 months. I'm like, so something you do today the right way, you're perfect today. You're going to look at it in 6 months and go, I could do it better now, right? I know more. I would do it different. And you kind of see people go like, yeah, like that's going to happen. So then the follow-up is, so we need to be okay. Like if we want learning and growth, we have to realize we don't know how to do it perfectly right now, right? And what we're aiming for is not perfection. And we're really aiming for building something that meets the needs of the business. And I really try and connect, what the value of software engineering inside of organizations isn't to write the perfect code. It's to get a job done. And that can be very, very valuable. A lot of software engineers want the job to be about inventing things with code, or writing code a specific way, or adhering to some tenets of coding practices that they consider the best. And like we want good, but there's more qualitative, there's more art in this world than hard science. And it really is a craft. And just like if you're building chairs to sell, at some point you got to call it good enough to go out there and sell it, right? And at the end of the day, it's not a rocket ship taking people to the moon. It's a chair. So you gotta, your tolerances and your materials need to be aligned to the job too.
Oh, that's funny. So, I heard a very successful businessman. He started a SaaS company that last I heard was doing like 300 million or so a year. And he's got a series of books, and he was doing an event one time, and somebody said they wanted a book, and he's like, well, why don't you have it? And they're like, well, I don't want to write a book that embarrasses me. And he said, you just need to be publishing as fast as you can. And he's like, and if you don't look back at your book 5 years from now and are not embarrassed by what you wrote, he's like, you're not growing as a business person. And I've never forgot that, where I was just like, that's such an interesting philosophy. He's like, yeah, that book I wrote 10 years ago, I'm completely embarrassed by that because I know so much more now. And I just thought that was interesting. So for you, learning to basically write in ones and zeros for your whole career, how was it trying to tackle a dissertation?
The shift to like the leadership and management stuff, you have to, it's about communication. And so it really is wild. Like when I was young, I had like you said, I did not enjoy writing in school. I just felt like it's a hassle. But in the real world, you have to have some level of communications ability to succeed, because most of the time you're having to deal with people. And this whole idea of like helping be a force multiplier for a team of people, you have to know how to communicate. And so writing is still very important.
Well, you're also talking about a very specific academic style of writing too, which is his
It's
own skill set.
that comes with, yeah, I mean, it's its own thing. You kind of cut your teeth by reading and responding a lot and writing small stuff, and you pick up the voice in there. And then during the process, it just becomes what you're writing. And I'm sure a lot of my business communications took on an academic tone to it. But But yeah, it was looking back. I mean, it ended up being something like 300 and something pages
Yeah,
of
it's
a
no joke.
document,
You've already written your first book or two.
so it was a great experience, a great learning experience too.
When I so I did my master's degree and got an MFA in writing, shocking for an author. And it was funny because I spent $50,000 to get my MBA, and then I ended up just through happenstance going into the direct response sales copy world. And one of sort of the tenets of direct response sales copy is everything has to be very simple. And so the way they do that is through reading greed level. You run your paper, your sales letter through a thing, and they want to they shoot for the like 6th to 7th grade reading level. And like that entire first year of my of in that thing, like I was my managers were yelling at me, this is like 14th grade. I was like, because I just spent 2 years writing academic work, and it took me a full year to learn the new skill of writing things at a 7th grade level. So it was just funny to me of like, oh, you think, oh, writing is writing. And I was like, man, I was learning a whole new language writing for this particular industry. So let's talk a little bit about Firm Pilot AI. Who's your idea? Who's the type of organization that you can get like the best result for?
Somebody who knows who they are, really, because what we do is really just magnify their presence. If I was, if you had a competitor in the, in the author world, right, and you wanted
Sure.
to market yourself with one of like our services, the questions would be, can you describe yourself uniquely? Like, what is it that makes you different than, person down the street who's writing their book? So when we talk to these law firms, it's like, yeah, you're practicing law and the person down the street could buy our services too, but why are you different than them, right? How do you differentiate yourself to a human? Tell us that, because we put all that in our software.
That is a way to, they've probably never been asked that in the legal space. Everybody's like, no, I'm just a personal injury attorney, man.
And so we really have to dig in there and get them to, tell us who they are, the type of people they like to work with, if it's what side of the law do they want to be on, right? Do they want to be like working for the plaintiff or working for the defense? We've got people who and like really want to niche down, like what do you like to work on? And some people, want to be fight for the little guy, justice warriors. Some people want to be, I bring the money. I'll get you the biggest settlements. I'm a closer, or I'm very ethical, or I move fast. Whatever it is, it's them. And so we highlight that.
Wow.
We highlight that with the factual information about those topics. We talk about their ideal client, and we try and write for those situations. And we really just zero in. And we don't get upset if they work, if they want to write their own content or whatnot. We're providing some or all of their marketing, to get them the people they want. But we're not really ego driven. We're just data driven. We want to be factually accurate and just kind of get it
That
done.
is like so fascinating to me that you're combining the marketing space and SEO with like the data, right? Because most people, from my experience, a lot of people are all about like the quantity, right? So what is like, so is your system then designed to learn? So let's say again, let's say I come up and I sign up and starts to learn. So is the more I use your platform, do the agents start to understand sort of who my business is better and better, so we eventually get better and better content as we go? Or is that kind of all hard coded in the beginning where it's like you're.
There's some like analysis on so with blogs, you've got like systems like Google Analytics that can track the engagement of a particular piece of content. We can measure we can hook into that and measure the engagement. So over time, we'll notice what aspects of our system's writing is working, right? And so we can dial in and say, you know, this blog post was written by this model with these parameters with, and it outperformed this other piece. And even if as a human we like the other piece, it's like, well, the data is showing us this is speaking to people. And so we'll continue to tune towards that that way. The system, honestly, it's not like a ChatGPT experience.
Sure.
Ours is you inform it, we enter in all of this information, and then it really is it can just disappear. It will ship a blog to your website, it'll post to your ex, it'll update your Google business profile. If you want to spot check it yourself, you can set a flag and it'll, you know, you got to hit, you know, you can review and proof it and hit approve. But a lot of customers, just once they get the confidence in the system, they just turn it on auto publish, and it goes out on a schedule. And we also try and space it out. So if you get, you know, if you buy like a four blog package from us, it's not, you know, first week, first day of the month, you get four. we space them out, and the system tries to be strategic where, you know, whatever, again, like whatever you're wanting to optimize, and your social media might boost a blog post or something like that.
So it's fascinating to me that you've taken, you know, a pretty sort of labor intensive marketing team, and you've built this whole SaaS environment around it. Do you think that that's the potential for AI in like multiple industries? And if so, like, how do you feel companies are doing and adopting that as where we're at right now and moving forward? Because what you're saying to me is like, I get it. It's a lot. I've heard about this for 2 years, but you guys seem to be the sort of the first real world boots on the ground company that's actually figured out how to do it in a way that's easy for a user to experience.
So I think a lot of it comes down to focus. And so we're not focused on all of marketing. First we niche down to like it's firm pilot. So it's law firms is the vast majority of our clientele. Our CEO has a law degree. His brother's a practicing attorney. So
they were already aware of the pain in the market that, when you get
started.
There's a whole
personal story of the genesis. He had a tech guy, and his brother was getting beat up with high marketing agency costs. And he's like, hey, you know, maybe we can automate some of this. And, you know, but we're not trying to boil the ocean. And we're not trying to oversell. We're trying to say we do this subset of marketing activities. We do it, you know, with low to no ego. It's all data driven. And I believe that, you know, we're not putting all marketers, like we don't talk about like cutthroat stuff internally. We're not putting all marketers out of business. We're not, you know, making the marketing AI to end human marketing. What I think we're doing is lifting certain things, certain behaviors, certain activities to allow humans to fill the spaces where AI isn't doing well right now, maybe ever, and probably the areas where that true breadth of real world experience and creativity come into play.
Yeah, I love it. And you know, you're taking a process and systematizing it, and making it more efficient. It's like it's almost like you wrote a PhD with, you know, continuous improvement or something.
the tech world's hit this so many times. I mean, you know, there's been so many technologies inside of software engineering that have come out, and people who were using the current state of the art looked at the stuff coming in and were like, oh, this is going to ruin everything. Like, it's going to make it so easy. Everybody's going to forget how to do it for real. And like it hasn't happened yet. And that doesn't mean it couldn't happen, but all of this fear that AI is gonna
Replace.
take it, like replace everything, and there's not gonna be something else.
Yeah, everything has always created something else. You know, it's like the guy I referenced earlier, like the, you know, has a software that you know, $300 million software, but like that literally created like two new entire industries that are just supporting people using that software. And it's phenomenal to watch that. And I always thought, you know, people ask me all the time, like, oh my God, like AI, aren't you afraid that you're going to go out of business and AI's going to do everything? I was like, I use AI in my writing. It's great brainstorming. It's great for editing, but I still have humans in my process still. Because you know why? Because AI, I can't give AI my book and then say, hey, tell me how you felt when you read it. You know, maybe in our lifetime, we'll, you know, I'll have some sort of John bot there that will be like, yes, I read your book and let me tell you what a 24-year-old would feel, what a 37-year-old would feel. Maybe we'll get there, but right now we're a far cry from that.
I'm sure. I mean, I'm sure just in the literary world, people probably thought, you know, handwriting versus typewriters versus electronic typewriters, and then like word processors. It's just gonna,
Gonna destroy everything.
it's gonna ruin everything. The real writings with a pen, or the, you know, the real writings with a quill. You know, and look at how much is written and still written and consumed and useful. It's amazing.
Yeah, you're still, you know, you still, it's sort of like, I mean, it's probably with you in code, right? Everybody's like, oh, AI is no code. But I, as somebody who's not a coder, if I use no code and something's not working, I'm not going to know why. Whereas you could use AI or create something and you get in there and be like, oh man, here's why it's not working. Right. So it's sort of with marketing or sales copy or writing, like sales copy. Can AI write a sales letter? Yes. But you have to understand a little bit about sales copy to understand if what it just wrote you is actually a good sales letter. Right. So you still need to have the foundational things to know, like what kind of output are you getting? And again, maybe in our lifetime we'll get past that. I don't know. But right now like I said, I still feel like I made the joke the other day where, you know, the internet came on in like 2003 to 2009 was sort of like this internet thing is changing everything, right? But I don't feel until like 2020 that the world went, oh, there's this internet thing and you can actually do stuff on it. It's kind of like before then, it was like, you know, there's still such a huge part of the population that just engaged with the internet to watch something versus like, oh, you can do all this other stuff. And I sort of feel like we're there with AI, right? People right now are still, and eventually there'll come a point where something will happen and people are like, oh, there's this AI thing. Look what we can do with it. So if somebody's listening to this episode or reading this chapter in the book, where can they go to engage with Firm Pilot?
Just firmpilot.com is where we're at.
Yeah, it's pretty easy. Two final questions for you. By the end of the decade, where do you, with the growth you've seen with Firm Pilot right now, where would you like to see Firm Pilot be by the time we hit, you know, 2030?
We're doing the double, triple. We've been tripling every year, so you know
Wow.
we're trying to maintain that pace for the next to probably, you know, as long as we can sustain it. And like I said, we're growing, and we're building this hopefully resilient culture that we're, you know, like we're prepped for growth, and we know it's going to be difficult, but we're excited for that difficulty. So well, you know, we're hoping to actually, you know, like we're aiming for that $1 billion company status, honestly, is where we're looking at. And I think what we do can apply to, you know, other business verticals as well. So we're hoping to, you know, we've got different ideas of expansion, and again, we'll have to be adaptable and figure out what's going to work as we go. But yeah, I mean, just pedal
Well, I
down.
mean, if you were where you are right now and you're primarily law firms, I mean, boy, yeah, you eventually, even just starting with like, laterally going like, oh, plastic surgeons and chiropractors, right? And then laterally out from that, I'm like, oh, we could go, and eventually, authors and writers, right? And publishers. the final question, this has nothing to do with anything we've been talking about.
Okay.
What is the most difficult weld you've ever had to do?
Aluminum. I was able to get a nice TIG welder. I was able to get a budget TIG welder, which you need for aluminum, because I had a cracked aluminum pump on a pressure washer. And aluminum is a very difficult metal to weld.
Were you able to fix it?
I was able to fix it, which was good, because I told my wife I can fix this for the same price as buying a new pressure washer. So it's a break-even purchase, but I had to actually, get it done.
Was there any moments when you were doing that where you're like, I don't know if I'm going to pull this one off?
It was, I had many days of practice where I was like, this is just terrible. And that's like where you see the theory and the practice, right? They're not the same thing.
The reason I ask is I had a friend who was a welder, and he was in the military. He learned to weld in the army.
Mm.
And he said that they, had gone through their 9 months of training or whatever. And then the final sort of exam, and they took him in the hangar. And he said there was just this just pile of metal. Tin and aluminum and steel and this and copper and bronze, and the guy was just like, all of that has to be welded together and hold up. And then everybody was like, what? And he's like it was not a one-day project.
Yeah, and you got to figure, think on your feet, I'm sure, there's the book learning, but now you've got this real world junk and a task. So
well,
get it done.
And it's also the fact of you're doing iron on iron or steel on steel. Exactly. Oh, great. But suddenly it's like, how do I get bronze and iron to stick together?
Yeah. And And that's the great thing about, the clarity of a goal. Sometimes you just have to have that person to go, well, here's that impossible task, right? Here are your tools, get it done. And some people just, break down, and other people are like, I'm going to go write that book instead of going, that's too big for me.
I love it. John, thank you so much for your time.
This
was
great.
Appreciate you taking time out of your day to be here.
This was wonderful. Thank you very much.